I'd like to share this morning on the theme of big history as the great story and why that matters in a warming world. First of all, big history is the academic discipline that term has been in use now for about 25 years. It's basically the history of everyone and everything. It's physical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution as our first and only globally produced evidence-based creation story. It's our modern-day Genesis. And the reason that creation stories matter is because every culture's creation story gives them a sense of who they are, where they are in time and space, how they got there, and what it means to move forward in some kind of a healthy capacity, some kind of a healthy way. We have been without a guiding narrative for quite some time now, because most of us, certainly in this room, and even most Christians still, don't take Genesis exactly literally. We don't really believe that there was a snake that talked. We don't really believe that the world was created in 6 days. And yet, so many of the liturgical traditions go through the motions as if this is truly still our sacred story. It's not. And if we think it is, we're in deep trouble. Because it's the story that science, that evidence gives us, that, as that quote from Brian Swim, allows us to hold all the other creation stories and creation myths in a way that allows us to cherish the role that they played, but also to not do so in a way that blinds us to the challenges of our time and to what we know evidentially is the case about who we are, where we're going, and how we fit in. So I have 3 points that I want to make this morning. The first is that we are a lot older, bigger, more related, and less central than we've been led to believe. And I'll use as my sort of prop here my cosmic rosary. I grew up Catholic. You can't get the Catholic out of me. You know, I got my cosmic. So I've got 270 of the major transformational moments in the history of the universe represented in beads. Each bead signifies some significant event in big history, in the universe story, or what Edward O. Wilson called it, the evolutionary epic. He said it's the greatest myth we will ever have. And so we get our sense of self because we now know that we are as large as the universe. The universe has been unfolding and expanding for some 13.8 billion years, and we're not separate from that process. We are that process, become conscious of itself. The universe as a whole has gone from simple atoms, to molecules, to more complex molecules, to creatures, to more complex creatures, and then societies and more complex societies. And we are that process becoming aware of itself. The universe has been unfolding and expanding, and then in this solar system, the universe became complex enough that it could begin to contemplate its own nature. We are nature uncovering its own nature. We're the universe becoming aware of itself, literally. The physicist I quoted earlier, Brian Swim, has 2 quotes that just sort of help people get it. He says, 4 billion years ago, the Earth was molten rock, and now it sings opera. Earth was once molten rock, and now it sings opera. Right? And nobody put anything here. Right? When the Bible, like Genesis 2:7, speaks of God forming us from the dust of the ground and breathing into us the breath of life, that's a personification. It's a mythic way of describing the fact that we grow out of the planet in the same way that apples grow out of an apple tree. We're organically related to the whole. Here's another quote from Brian Swim that I think you'll like, although this one's a little bit more audacious. He tries to take the entire 13.8 billion year story of the universe and sum it up in 2 sentences. He says, you take a great cloud of hydrogen gas and you just leave it alone, and it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings. And that is what science tells us. That's our evolutionary story. It's the epic of evolution. It's big history. So it lets us know that we are 13.8 billion years old. In fact, some of the atoms of our bodies, the hydrogen atoms. See, we drink water. Where's my water bottle? Yeah. We are mostly water. We're 70% water. And of course, all the hydrogen atoms in the H2O, the hydrogen atoms were created at the beginning of time, 13.8 billion years ago. So all the hydrogen atoms in your body are 13.8 billion years old. So we're older than we thought. In fact, you know, how many of us try to hide our age? You know? You should celebrate your age. You're a lot older than you thought you were anyway, right? So we're bigger, we're older, but we're also more related. We now know, we don't believe this. This isn't about beliefs, it's about knowledge. We now know that we are genetically related to other creatures. In fact, all other creatures. In fact, Marlon Lavanar is the pastor of the largest Unitarian Universalist church in the world in Tulsa, Oklahoma, All Souls. I love this quote. He says, you know, we've all heard some fundamentalist-minded person say, don't tell me I'm related to monkeys. But now that we understand DNA and it cracked its code, we know that we're not just related to monkeys. We're related to zucchini, so let's get over it. So we're bigger, we're older, we're more related, but we're not as central as we thought we were. We thought, in fact, all cultures thought that the world was made for us. And what we're now finally realizing evidentially is that we were made to be a blessing. We're made for the world. In fact, if we don't come into right relationship with this planet, if we stop seeing ourselves as the pinnacle that everything leads to us, we're going to cause our own extinction if we continue thinking that way. But we do have an amazing role. I mean, think about it from the dinosaur's perspective. These amazing, majestic beings, some of the most awesome beings, certainly in Earth's history, they dominated the planet for like 150 million years. These incredible beings were lost to the Earth community 65 million years ago. They went extinct, right? And their memory was lost to the Earth community. No other species knew about the dinosaurs once they were gone until us. And we are the first creature to dig up. I mean, do you know of any other animal that digs up dinosaur bones and builds monuments to dinosaurs? You know, like museums? We do. So we're the story remembering its story. We are nature uncovering its own nature. So that does give us a significant role, but not if we think the whole thing was here for us. I mean, think about it. You've got a 13.8 billion year process. Now, if you compress 13.8 billion years into 100 years, like just for, you know, understanding purposes, like if you think of the universe as 100 years old, at that time scale, do you know when humans show up? December 25th, interestingly enough, Christmas Day of the 99th year is when Homo habilis, walking upright using stone tools. We domesticated fire on December 29th, Homo erectus, and we've been speaking, verbal, symbolic speaking Homo sapiens, on December 31st of the 99th year. Now think about it. We've got 99 years, 364 days, and on the last day of a 100-year process is when human beings emerge out of the body of life. Or if you want to use mythic language, when the goddess created us, or when God created us. Now, I don't know about you, but if we show up on the last day of a 100-year process, to me it indicates at least the possibility that the whole thing wasn't meant for us. You know? And so we need to be humble about our relationship to this process, or we will be booted out of the body of life. We will go extinct. So this is my second point. The first one, of course, being that we're older, we're bigger, we're more related, and we're not as central as we thought we were, as our religions have led us to believe. The second point is that we will either come into right relationship, that is an honorable relationship with reality, an honorable relationship to nature, an honorable relationship to time. We will either do that or we will go extinct. We know of no culture in the entire history of the world, and certainly, I mean, in human history, we know of no culture that survived for any length of time that didn't have an I-thou relationship to the natural world. See, we have an I-it relationship, because for the last 600 years, 550 years or so, we've been using clocks as our basic analogy or metaphor for nature. See, what happened was we invented pendulum clocks. And once we invented pendulum clocks, we started thinking, you know, before we had clocks, think about any technology, right? A plow, for example. You use a plow. You plow, you set it down, and it just sits there, right? But clocks, you wind them up, they keep working. It was like, whoa, We just became enamored with clocks. So we thought of that as an analogy for nature. The problem is it does two things. One is a clockwork universe. When you think of the universe in clockwork terms, it trivializes God and it desacralizes nature. God is no longer immanent and omnipresent. God is no longer a synonym or personification of some aspect of reality or reality as a whole. God is now an idea, a clockmaker outside a clockwork universe that you can either believe in or not. And you've got this insane worldview that literally causes good people to do dangerous and damaging things. I'll say a whole lot more about that at 12:30. Good people are dangerous, and great people can engage in great evil when their map of reality is outdated, or if they privilege ancient mythic texts over current evidential revelation. So what science has now showed us is that we have no evidence that any culture can survive for long without having an I-thou relationship to nature. See, religions are failing in their, and I'm saying all religions, are failing in their most fundamental task, which is to help us live in right relationship to reality. That's what religions are supposed to be about, is helping us live in right relationship to reality. In fact, Loyal Rue is a philosopher of religion. He wrote a book called Religion is Not About God. And what he means is that religion is about our relationship to reality. And yes, reality can be personified as the various gods and goddesses, and has been. But what religion's about, if it's doing its job, is helping us live in right relationship to what's inescapably real. All gods and goddesses are personifications, not persons. Gaia was a personification of Earth, not the goddess of the Earth. Gaia wasn't the spirit of the Earth. Gaia was a personification of Earth. Poseidon was a personification of the seas. Eros was a personification of love or lust. These are personifications. If you don't understand personification, you can't possibly understand religion or the world's myths, period. You can't. It's the most important scientific discovery about religion in the last 100 years is personification. That is, our brains inherently are relational. We personify. Now, fortunately, there's some people that are starting to get this in spades, even in Hollywood. So I want to share with you a two-minute video that uses personification in a modern-day, very powerful way.
Some call me nature. Others call me Mother Nature. I've been here for over 4.5 billion years, 22,500 times longer than you. I don't really need people, but people need me. Yes, your future depends on me. When I thrive, you thrive. When I falter, you falter. Or worse. But I've been here for eons. I have fed species greater than you, and I have starved species greater than you. My oceans, my soil, my flowing streams, my forests, they all can take you or leave you. How you choose to live each day, whether you regard or disregard me, doesn't really matter to me, one way or the other. Your actions will determine your fate, not mine. I am nature. I will go on. I am prepared to evolve. Are you?
There have been about six of those that have been made now. If you just put natureisspeaking.com, you'll see one of the ones I'll show this afternoon at 12:30 or probably about 12:45 is Harrison Ford speaks as the oceans. Talk about Poseidon. Anyway, my point being that what is vital for us to move into a healthy future is relating to nature in a respectful, honorable way. See, all, I mentioned all gods and goddesses personifications, but the personifications of some aspect of our inner nature or our outer nature. But as long as we think of God in trivial, impotent, inconsequential ways, as a supreme landlord, for example, who resides off the planet and outside the universe, who blesses some and smites others, who's for this football team but not that football team. I know I'm in trouble here, I'm sure. Then religion can't possibly do its task. And we're going to see this science and religion war. I mean, one of the great, there's two great insanities I see today. One of them is that we allow corporations to get wealthy by polluting the air, water, soil, and life upon which we all depend. The fact that we have not yet taxed carbon, that is, we have not yet integrated the true price of carbon dioxide, the fact that we allow corporations to get wealthy by putting carbon into the atmosphere or toxins into the soil or toxins into the water is absolutely crazy. This is collective insanity. It comes out of our mechanistic understanding of the universe. We have not related to nature in an honorable, respectful way. And by doing that, we are betraying future generations. So that's one of the collective insanities. The other collective insanity is the theist-atheist debate. You've got tens of thousands, even millions of people that are debating whether or not God exists or whether or not God is real, when the one real God, namely nature or reality personified or not, we've been out of right relationship to, and we are now about to experience consequences of biblical proportion. And yet you got all these people debating about whether or not God is real. And both of them have a trivial, impotent, inconsequential, fictional understanding of God in mind. I'll do a whole bunch of that in my workshop. So my third point, I want to conclude with where we go from here. First point, we're a lot older, bigger, more related, and less central than we thought, and that our religions have led us to believe. Number two is that our religions are failing us in the most important thing, which is helping us live in right relationship to reality. And the primary face of reality that we need to live in right relationship to is nature. Both our inner nature and especially our outer nature. The third point becomes really clear. And it can be summed up by my great mentor, Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry called himself not a theologian. He called himself a geologian. Theologian of the earth. Right? And he said that our present condition, our present predicament, and our way into the future can be summarized in three simple sentences. First sentence. The glory in the 20th century and early 21st century, the glory of the human has become the desolation of the earth. Second sentence, the desolation of the earth is becoming the great shame of the human. Third sentence, therefore, all programs, policies, activities, and institutions must henceforth be judged primarily by the extent to which they inhibit, ignore, or foster a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. In other words, given the fact that, yes, things have been getting better and better for many humans, longer lives, greater comfort, greater wealth, greater ease in many cases, it's happened at the expense of the natural world, because you can't have a growing gross domestic product or gross national product and a decreasing gross earth product. It's suicidally unsustainable. So yes, the glory of the human has become the desolation of the earth. The desolation of the earth is becoming the great shame of the human. Therefore, from this point on, everything, all of our programs, our institutions, our policies, our activities, our religions, our politicians, our corporations, everything must be judged from here on out by the extent to which it inhibits, ignores, or fosters a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. And so that gives us our mission. Because what we realize is that reality is our God. That is, reality is our ultimate commitment. Not some supernatural being, but reality, whether you personify it or not. Evidence is our scripture. That is, evidence is the main way reality is revealing itself to us today. Scientific evidence, historic evidence, and cross-cultural evidence. Big history is our creation story. This is our epic. This is the story that lets us know who we are, where we are, how everything fits in, and how we can move forward. Ecology is our theology. Ecology, after all, is the science of living in right relationship to both time and to nature. So when we move forward with this understanding, there's a hope that comes not from some pie in the sky hope, but comes from the hope that I can speak, for example, about climate change. And again, I'll go into a lot more of this at 12:30 and beyond. But I can say the good news about climate change in five words. We can see it coming. Never in the history of the entire world has any species been able to see a potential extinction-level event coming in time to ward off the worst and to prepare for what's already baked in the system. That's really good news. So we're older, larger, more related, and a lot less central than we thought we were. Religions are failing in their fundamental task. They need to repent. Religions now need to help us come into right relationship with nature, which, of course, all the indigenous cosmologies did. How did they do so? Simply by having an I-thou relationship to nature. And then finally, our way into the future is clear. Everything needs to be done from this point on with the thought, does this contribute to a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship? Does it ignore a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship? Or does it hinder a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship? Everything must be judged by that. I'd like to close with my favorite one-line piece of scripture from Carl Sagan. Science is at least in part informed worship. Science is at least in part informed worship. Thank you.